Hello, friend. Aftermarket Podcast Guy here, Carm Capriato. So glad you're tuning in to Aftermarket Talk Radio that goes beyond the norm as we work hard to diversify our topics, our formats, and bring you up close and personal interviews that share the power of wisdom. I'd like to give thanks to our loyal fans and subscribers who've tuned in for over the last 5 years on their favorite podcast listening app. And I'm grateful for every new listener we get every day. Today, listen to my fourth episode with industry icon Mitch Schneider. I'm calling it the broken arm episode. You'll find out why. Mitch brought his unmistakable wit and charm to this interview as we turned on the recorder and just let it flow. Unscripted. No intended agenda, so this is pure and raw podcasting at its best. The episode was also recorded for video. You can see it on my YouTube channel or on the show notes page at remarkableresults.biz/E558. Yeah, you get a chance to see behind the scenes of a podcast recording session. Hey, none of this is possible without my sponsors. You know, it's Apex and Shopware that bring you this Friday episode. You know, Apex, they've got some big and important names on the training schedule in the new Repair Shop HQ this year. You'll learn from the most sought-after and experienced trainers like John Thornton, Jeremy O'Neill, Eric Ziegler, Jim Wilson, and Mike Reynolds, and many others. The best part, their classes are included in the $40 online attendee registration. To see the training schedule and to sign up for Apex, go to aapexshow.com. Now, more than ever with the pandemic, you're focused on bringing cars through your bays safely and efficiently. Shopware's shop management system offers a completely contactless workflow. Your customers can review, approve, and even pay for the repairs right from their smartphone or personal device. Request a demo and see them in action at getshopware.com. Hey, keep in mind, the essential voices of the aftermarket reside right here. And that is why I podcast.
Once you've been exposed to something like that, you can't unlearn it. You can't unsee it. You can't unthink it. And that's what I hope for the people in this industry. I hope that they recognize how important they are and make the investment in their own future that they're going to need to make if they intend to be here 2 or 3 or 5 years from now.
Hey, thanks again for tuning in. Have you seen the new show, AftermarketWeekly.com? Well, it's a live show every Tuesday at noon Eastern Time. Every episode is available on the AftermarketWeekly.com website, and you'll find really fun and interesting topics in the form of a magazine-style show, all aftermarket-focused, and it includes a shop tour. We've been to shops all over the country, and you may just take a great idea from one of them. Guaranteed, AftermarketWeekly.com. Every time I have a chat with Mitch Schneider, I feel honored. I've read him for years, and as you'll hear, like two old shoes, we're worn in, comfortable, and we're coveted. You never want to get rid of them. If you've read Mitch for decades in our aftermarket press, and in fact, he's still writing, this is like a live article on many, many topics. We talk about his book, Misfire, Wisdom on Learning, The Power of Reading, and his perspective on the tech shortage, and a whole lot more. Find the show notes and key talking points for Mitch Schneider at remarkableresults.biz/E558. Enjoy. Hey, a warm welcome to my friend Mitch Schneider. I don't know how long it's been, how many you've been on, but I'm honored to have you on again.
It's great to be here. It's an honor to be asked.
For anyone who's listening audio and you can't see the video, Mitch has a cast.
It's a lot more inconvenient than you think it is.
Oh, trust me, I know, because it was my right arm when I was in junior high that I broke. A tree fell on me. It's a long story. It broke way up near the socket. It pulled apart. And the doctor said, there's not much we can do, but set it, just like yours is. You know, the whole elbow thing, talk about itching and scratching. Well, I went through all of seventh grade, almost a year, 6 months with the cast, and then another year of immobility, and no gym, no outdoor activities during that really formative time of my life. And that's when I got a little chubby. I won't forget that.
I wish I had a story that was as exciting as that. I mean, I was walking. My right foot stopped, the rest of me didn't, and just went forward, tried to catch up, which was probably the worst thing I could do. And the thing that really frustrates me more than anything else is that I know how to fall. I mean, I've been trained on how to fall. I started to go down that way and roll into it, and then at the last minute, I reached out with my left hand and straight-armed the asphalt.
Yeah, you're a martial arts person. I mean, you know, one of the things that I don't think people understand about Misfire, the book, is how incredibly, you know, self-indulgent that book was. You know, when I read it, knowing how much you knew about martial arts, and you taught me an awful lot that I didn't know about martial arts by just reading Misfire. Came to respect the discipline, I guess, and how you connected the discipline of martial arts to the success of the shop owner, martial arts expert. You know, all I could think of was you were the guy, you were him.
Discipline is critical to success in any kind of an endeavor, right? You've got to show up. And as my dad always said, you got to want to fix the car, you got to want to fix the business, you got to want to fix the car, you got to want to, whatever it is that you need to do. Discipline's one of those D words we talk about in the book that's so critical. There was another chapter on C words like character and commitment and words like that. But I was talking to somebody about the book earlier this morning, and it was really funny. And they were talking about all the lessons that were all in the chapters and whether or not it was meant to be that way. I said every chapter that's in that book had a fight for space in the book because there were a bunch that didn't make it. Those were good lessons.
We need outtakes. We need to have the little paperback on what didn't make it.
We're working on that. I got slowed down. I was almost done with the edit of the first supplement, the first handbook on customer care. And I was just ready to start writing the last two chapters that I was going to add to that book. I've discovered that my Mac comes with dictation software.
I think a lot about that. I mean, just about anything I touch also has dictation. And I keep thinking, why am I typing when I could be speaking? You know, I've got microphone in my office, microphone in the studio. I mean, I could be doing all of that, but somehow
it's a different discipline. It's got to be something that comes from a different part of the brain.
So it's mind to fingers. I can't get the mind to mouth to work yet. I can come in a studio totally unscripted, you know, off the cuff with Mitch Snyder here, and it works. Mind to mouth, it works. It's just two friends having coffee. Has COVID affected, you know, your whole recovery, being careful?
When it comes to isolation and distancing and I wore a mask the whole time I was in the hospital and when I got out. So from the end of March until now. So it's been over a year.
I got a couple of things that went through my mind. You know, you wrote articles for years. I used to love getting the magazines back in the industry. I couldn't wait to read Mitch Snyder. Any favorite articles or topics you loved to write about?
Let's go back to the beginning. There was an article that I wrote very early in my writing career called The Teller of Tales. It's actually one of Tony Mullah's favorite articles. If you get him on the side, you can ask him about it. He'll tell you about it. I was still at Motor Service then. Tony was the guy who got me to go from Motor Service to Motor Age and then left and went on to other things. You know, I had a great career at Motor Age. I got nothing to say but the best of things about my time there, or my time at Babcock's was a wonderful experience. They're incredible people. The aftermarket is blessed to have people like that involved, probably more than they appreciate or understand. But The Teller of Tales was about an era in which there were no cars or trucks that ran because the people entrusted with their care and custody been ignored and had all gone away. So every once in a while, the storyteller in an automotive repair shop, everybody would come in. And while he was working on this ancient vehicle to get it to run, he would tell them stories. So The Teller of Tales had to be one of my very, very favorite columns because it looked into a very dark future that is still very possible about the change, the nature of change that was going to occur in our business if we didn't pay attention.
You know, Mitch, I just did some research on some trending topics in the industry, and I did bump across an article that showed the city of New York streets the way they're so empty, you know, back at least a month and a half ago, and saying that that's the future. And it, you know, I started to read the article and realize how left-leaning it was, and I'm not talking about picking a side here, but how the world would be better without vehicles, period. I got a weird feeling about, you know, those kinds of articles that are being written.
I don't know that the world would be better. I think that we could be more responsible environmentally. I know that while everything was shut down here in Los Angeles, the sky has never been that blue since I've been here. That starts in 1962. There was one morning where we had an appointment at the City of Hope, and there's a point at which you transition from the 118 freeway to the 210, and you come around a bend. You could see forever. I mean, you could see so far that you could see the mountains that you can never see, and you could see that there was snow on the mountains. And it was beautiful. It was just inspiring. I think that things will change dramatically. I think that there will be far less cars. I think we've already seen statistics and surveys that show that millennials are not as tied to personal transportation as their parents are or their grandparents are. They're just as likely to take a Lyft or an Uber or alternative transportation. So I think that things are going to change. And I think that one of the few things that's going to mitigate the shortage of technicians that we're going to find ourselves in that's been increasing over time is the fact that the demand will slack off as the technological ability of the industry to fix those cars increases. There'll be fewer people working on fewer cars, but the technology will be much more sophisticated.
Like a specialist, Mitch, where you're going to go to a GP for, you know, it hurts me over here. You're going to probably go to a specialist if you have any other than maintenance undercar problems. You're going to have to go to a brainiac. I have an eye issue, and I went to an eye surgeon because, of course, the normal eye doctor wasn't going to touch it. So is that where automotive is going to go? Or are we just going to have the experts in a Euro shop just do Euro A to Z? Or are we going to have a Euro maintenance shop and a Euro diagnostics shop? I mean, could we ever focus that way? Or are we just going to keep blurring?
I think there's going to be an attempt to focus that way. And I think that it's going to get blurred. I think that both answers are correct to a degree. Electronic content of the vehicle has gotten to the point where it's so sophisticated that I don't know that any generalist is going to be able to handle it. They may understand it, but I don't know that they'll understand it with a depth of knowledge sufficient to diagnose it. I don't know. I know that there are problems that I've seen friends of mine have with their vehicles that they have had great difficulty getting resolved. And that's including the dealership network. As a matter of fact, most of the time they've gotten the problem resolved outside the dealership network because they were the only ones that would dedicate the time necessary to figure out what was wrong with it and then fix it. So,
hey, today's pandemic is causing so much stress and uncertainty for everyone right now, especially shop owners. Now, how do I make sure that my staff and my customers stay protected while still moving cars through the bays? Contactless service is our new normal, and having a shop management system that not only supports this, but actually helps your business thrive through it all, is key. Shopware's digital workflow with remote pay will provide that solution for you. Amy Matinet from Auto Craftsman recently commented on social media, and I quote, "I can't even express how grateful I am that I jumped on board with Shopware on January 1st. Would have never guessed that I would be the only one writing service at my shop, as I haven't worked in the shop for the last 15 years. But she goes on and says, I'm running my shop nonstop every day with Shopware to help me not only get the job done easier and faster, but am totally wowing my customers." End quote. Hey, if you want to wow your customers too, request a demo at getshopware.com. Hey, Apex listened, and as a result, get ready for the new Repair Shop HQ. This area is for service professionals, your own place while at Apex. It's a one-stop shop for all your service and repair needs. It includes technical and management classes taught by the industry's most sought-after and experienced trainers. These classes and instructors were selected by a panel of shop owners and technicians to be on target with what you need to drive your business forward. There will also be hands-on product demos in Joe's Garage, a simulated shop environment with 6 service bays, lifts, running vehicles, and a source capture vehicle exhaust extraction system so it all runs. Plus, you'll get to see new tools and equipment, the latest in heating and AC, and dedicated sections for tires, alternative fuels, diagnostics, and telematics. I know you can't wait to check out Repair Shop HQ. That's where you'll find my podcast studio. Hey, take a look at the training schedule and everything in Repair Shop HQ at aapexshow.com and register. The book, how's a book going?
It's going well. Slow, but good.
Good. Every chance I have to talk about it, I do, because I love the book. How do we make this the encyclopedia of our business?
I'm going to tell you a funny story about that. Leslie and I had to go up the coast for a specific appointment. We try really hard not to leave the house. We can avoid it based upon COVID and everything else that's going on. But it was the first time that we were both in the car and we had a chance to listen to the audio. And I had a chance to listen to it without editing it or without critiquing it or without working on it in some capacity. Actually had the opportunity to listen to it like a reader would read it or a listener would listen to it. I don't know, we were in the car about a half an hour when Leslie looked over and said, "This is really good." She said, "Do you know this is really good?" I said, "God, I hope so. I spent more than two years of my life, dedicated to this." She said, "No, but the narration's really good."
You got a voice actor that could play all the roles?
Yes, I did. We had a great voice actor do it, and he did a really, really great job. So I'm really pleased with the way it came out. And the sales are slow. They're picking up slowly, but it's like anything else worth accomplishing in life. You just put your shoulder against it, you lean on it, you push it. The wheel turns slightly, and then it, ever faster.
You push it uphill. I know you're doing everything you can to promote it. When someone like me reads the book and can't put it down, and, a week later, because it's a thick book, between everything else going on in your world, a week later, you read this thing, and then you get on a bully pulpit and say to anybody, "This is the book."
I was talking to somebody about it this morning for a book. They're reading, it's part of a book club, and they chose to read Misfire as part of the book club, which was a great honor. I was really, really jazzed about it. And they were talking about problems that they were having with the book, which for an author, it's wonderful to have that insight into what's going on when people are actually reading it, what they're taking out of it. And the biggest problem they were having is that everybody kept reading ahead. Everybody's, they're supposed to read certain sections and then wait for everybody else to catch up. No, and nobody's doing that.
I wouldn't have done that because, it's kind of like watching an episode of your favorite TV show in the binge mode. You why should I watch it every week, go through the commercials, wait till it goes on pay-per-view or streaming, and then you sit down and you watch four or five episodes one night and you say, you got to keep going. Hey, back to school. It was just a few years ago. Were you really, really good in school?
The honest answer is no. I had the attention span of a gnat. If we had a classroom that had a window, I was screwed because I'd be staring out the window. I had the horsepower mentally to be good at whatever I was doing. And I've got all the report cards that say Mitch is bright, intelligent, articulate.
Yeah, he's a great C student that could be an A if he stopped looking out the window.
And then when I discovered fixing cars, and every class I went to had my undivided attention. And then when I went back to writing again, storytelling again, I've always been a storyteller. But when we lived in New York, we lived in Oceanside, we had a house and we had a big bedroom. And all three of us lived in the same, my two brothers and I were in the same bedroom. And the only way we could get them to sleep at night was if I would tell them stories. So I used to make up stuff using superheroes from the comic books. And I would make up my own scripts.
You have an incredible gift for words and how you put it together. Every time I ever read an article throughout all the years, I probably read hundreds of them. They weren't hard to read, just like Misfire. It's easy, so easy to read. When you write, you're opinionated. You're telling stories of the things you feel. Anything in the last couple of years that has moved or changed your mind over your convictions of all these years?
The diagnosis in 2014 changed everything. That was a game changer. When a doctor tells you to go home and get your things in order, get your house in order, it's a very sobering message. We've talked about that before. I worked diligently to train my body to be prepared for stem cell bone marrow transplant if I was lucky enough, if I was fortunate enough to be accepted into that program, and I was. The transplant itself was a humbling experience, certainly on an intellectual level, when you recognize that a complete stranger halfway across the world in Israel gave me stem cells from his body that saved my life. And to this day, I have no idea who he is or where he is, other than the fact that at the time he was 18 and an Israeli who had 12 of the 14 markers that I have. So chances are, if I find a picture of him, he'll look like I did when I was in high school. It could be a relative, I suppose, but I don't know. In any case, that certainly changed my life dramatically and gave me a sense of purpose to give back, to leave something tangible behind, you know, a real legacy. And I think a legacy beyond just all the columns that I've written over the years.
Is the book in that category?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You were diagnosed in 2014. The book was already underway?
I had written a couple of chapters. I wouldn't have called them chapters at the time, but I had written what I considered an expanded column, you know, something that could have been 3 or 4 months worth of columns. And then I had put it away. And I found it while I was looking, you know, like so many other things, I found it while I was looking for something else, and I started to read it. And I said, this is good. I mean, this is really interesting. This is something that I need to do. And it became a compulsion. I mean, it just took over my life. I said, I need to do this. You've read the book. It's a 400-page book. The initial second draft was 167 pages. The couple of people that I trusted to look at it came back and told me that it needed more development. The characters were flat. They were two-dimensional. So I went back and I started to work on it again until I got it right and finally succeeded in doing that. But the book became that legacy project.
It wouldn't have been the book without that character development, in my opinion, because you really got to relate to everybody, and you were looking for, you know, the hero inside of this whole thing. You were thanking the shop owner who was teaching the contractor, and you were fighting for both of them, really. And you were fighting for the shop owner to keep teaching, to keep teaching, to keep teaching, and you were fighting for the contractor to fix himself and his business.
Yeah, and they were both flawed. Both characters were flawed. And needed to be. So many people I've been privileged to know and work with in my career. I mean, they're all Frankensteins. They're all pieced together from people I've worked with and people that I know and people that I care deeply about. And they all have something to say. They all have something to teach us, I think. In order for them to have taken up space in the book, they needed to fight for that space, just like the chapters needed to fight to be there.
And they all didn't make it. I just found
they all didn't make it. No. They all didn't make it.
Mitch and I have done, I think, 3 episodes in the past, Mitch, and one of them was on Misfire. Please, please, please read the book, but just go listen to Mitch and I just shooting the breeze about his world, his life, and of course, Misfire. Been pleasantly surprised by anything lately?
The genuine goodness of people. Yeah, and you can go back to the Israeli, my Israeli, or you can go back to the fact that when I fell in the street, I tried to correct myself and I went down hard and I knew that I'd broken my elbow. I mean, I knew it was broken because I saw dead relatives. I mean, it was excruciating pain, exquisite pain. And there was a young man, a teenager, that was out in the front yard of his house across the street from the school that we were walking alongside, the property that we were walking alongside, who called his mother out from the house immediately. And he came running over to see if he could help in any way. And we were walking with some friends of ours. You know, when I was finally coherent enough to speak, they said, we have a transport wheelchair in the house. Let me go get it for you so you don't have to walk, so that you can just sit down. So they ran in the house and they got the wheelchair. While they were getting the wheelchair, which we've been walking for about 2.5 miles, we walk about 3 to 5 miles a day, and we had already gone about 2.5 miles. While they were getting the wheelchair, a guy in an SUV, in a white SUV, stopped his car and said, is everything okay? Can I help you? I will drive you anywhere you need to go. If you want to go to a doctor, I'll take you to the doctor. If you want to go to the hospital, I'll take you to the hospital. He said, whatever you do, don't call 911 because they're going to call an ambulance. It's going to cost you $1,800 to get from here to the hospital, and they're going to take you wherever they want to go, not where you want to go. It was an amazing experience that they would do that. And they never, the people with the wheelchair never asked, who are you? Can I have your name? You want to give me your phone number to get the chair back? I mean, they just said, here, you need this. Take it. The genuine goodness of others is something that inspires me every day. And it's the willingness of some people to do the right thing. And I think that's worth getting inspired over.
Great story. And with all the craziness going on in our world, I mean, we need to hear stories like that.
I think so. I mean, we need to experience things like that. And in order for you to experience them, I think you need to open yourself up to the universe to see what's really out there. If you judge the world that you live in strictly by what's on the 6 o'clock news, you'll want to jump off a bridge. But there's so much more than that going on. There's so much goodness and so much caring.
There is, but it's not being discussed. It's not being shown. It's not being heard. This is just hit me really hard. Thank you. Because you said jump off a bridge, and I was going to say the highest ones so that it works. If you had any request of my audience, Mitch, what would you say to them right now?
The first thing I would tell them is that it's going to get better. This too shall pass. If you look it up, if you go online, there's a 9-year-old kid that emigrated here with his family from, I think, Nigeria, who's a chess champion, who's trying to become a master. 9 years old, just started playing a couple of years ago. And he's a brilliant chess player. And he said something that I would share with your audience right now. I haven't written about it yet, so whoever's going to watch this will know where it came from when they find it in a column. He was asked how he felt about losing, you know, losing a chess match. He looked at the interviewer, and this kid is 9 years old, and he says, "You don't lose, you just learn." And it's like my head was going to explode. You're going to make mistakes. Move on. Take every kernel of knowledge you can from what it is that you just experienced. Find the good in it. Figure out what you need to learn. What that challenge was presented to you for, right? Because it was presented to you so you could learn something from it and move on. Figure out what that something is and then use it. Move on. Don't make the same mistake again.
Think about your world, your life, your business, you know, all the things you've done. You've failed forward, or you failed and you learned, you lost and you learned. I guess if you don't beat yourself up too bad, you can accept that learning.
I did a pretty good job of beating myself up when I failed, but I still managed to pull something positive out of that experience. I could move forward and do a better job the next day so that I could bring a better self to whatever I was attempting the next day. Those are the kinds of lessons that we really need right now. There are people that you meet that somehow manage to equivocate success in business with being smart, with being, you know, strictly with being smart or being intelligent. And there are other elements that are involved in success. Maybe that's why I had so much trouble with that question. It depends on how we define what success means, because there are many different kinds of success. If I were to consider myself successful in my life, and I think I've accomplished a lot of things, I don't know that I feel like I am a success, because I still have lots of things left I want to do, I want to accomplish. And I tend to look forward to the next challenge rather than to where I am right now or where I've been before. If you're going to go ahead and try and figure out where you are, and I think that helps you to fall forward because you're always leaning in that direction. You're always leaning into the next challenge. And I think that's important. So when we talk about people in the industry, those are the kinds of lessons I've always tried to bring to my writing, to bring to the seminars that I did. I mean, even the keynotes that I've delivered over the years, I think it's really critically important that we find the good and then exploit it as much as we can.
Mitch and I, in one of the podcasts that we did, we talked about those keynotes in one of your earliest ones. You listen to me and Mitch do any of our episodes, and you've got, you know, totally a wisdom track going on just listening to Mitch. And, you know, I'm always so appreciative for him to come on. How much time do you allow every day for reading?
I try to read 15 minutes a day, minimum of 15 minutes a day, more if I can.
I interviewed an author today, got the book. And I knew that I had X amount of time to read it. Think about this. Here's my discipline. Even if I didn't have to interview the author and truly read the book from A to Z and understand it so that I could have a hell of an interview, John DeJulius, if I got a book because I just wanted to read it and I didn't set a, hey, please read this by then. If not, it just becomes dust or it just becomes a collector. If you're not doing that 15 minutes a day and you're not sliding a book into that hierarchy, that's a great thought. Of, you know, people say, well, I can't read, but I can't find time. Well, get up 15 minutes early, do your 15 minutes. Presto, a couple of weeks, you got the book done.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons we did an audio. It's because people can listen to it wherever they are. If you are what you eat, and doctors and dietitians and nutritionists have taught us that we are, then you certainly are what you think, and you think what you read. So the more you expose yourself to a better diet of more nutritious ideas, the faster you're going to move ahead on your journey.
Any thoughts going on with you? Anything you want to bring up?
I love the people in our industry. I think they just have no idea. I mean, it took a long time before anyone told them that they were essential, and we've been essential all along. I just wish they could see themselves through my eyes and enjoy the respect, appreciation, and admiration they deserve for the service they provide. One of the big changes in my life occurred when I realized that we didn't fix cars. That's not the business we were in. That's not the business we should aspire to be in. One of the big changes in my life came when I realized that we were in the freedom and mobility business, and that freedom and mobility had much more value than, you know, fixing broken cars. I wish that they could see that. I wrote Misfire for a number of different reasons. We've talked about that before, but one of the reasons is that I think that it's so much easier to convey complicated life lessons in a story that's relatable and relevant than it is in a traditional format of, you know, academic study. So creating this world in which Kurt and Robert and Allie and Chow-Li all lived and got to share their ideas is something that was important to me, because I think those people that read the book will have something that, you know, once you've been exposed to something like that, you can't unlearn it. You can't unsee it. You can't unthink it. And that's what I hope for the people in this industry. I hope that they recognize how important they are and make the investment in their own future that they're going to need to make if they intend to be here 2 or 3 or 5 years from now.
It took a pandemic to realize we were essential. I mean, well, there's the soundbite. I'm not sure if we realize how valuable that was to our industry and to our state of mind, to our well-being. The case studies that we've been doing on technology and DVI and cloud-based and training and marketing, all of that stuff that we've been, as an industry, you and me and the stories and the podcasts and every business coach and every great company that supports our industry, but going and going and teaching and training, and people saying, nah, I'll do it later, I'll do it later, I'll do it later. And the early adopters, they just slid through this thing. Because we were essential, it was easy, so easy to be essential. But because we were essential and we had to learn new things over touchless and safety and security of our people and our customers, for the early adopters, it was easy for them to do. For the ones that were really belabored and crushed under the things that they needed to do to run a better business. And hey, I may be wrong and I may be on my soapbox, but somehow I think some of the things that I'm saying have merit.
The lessons that some of us were forced to learn throughout all of the challenges that we've had to face, whether it was the recession in 2008 or any one of the number of other challenges that we've had, 9/11, I mean, you can go down the list, but the early innovators, the early adopters, are the ones that we need to watch and share their message with the rest of the industry. Because there's, as you move down those tiers, and we've talked about that before, if we move down those different levels of capacity, capability, those lessons get lost and they get diluted. And as you said, there's a whole gang of, you know, the majority of the industry perhaps that doesn't get it, is never going to get it.
What's going to happen to them?
Well, they may not know it, but they're going to, you know, the dinosaurs that had no idea that they were going to go away. There are people in this industry that are not going to be replaced. I think that you're going to find more shops get larger, become more sophisticated. Shop owners are going to learn how to run their shops better. New people are going to come into the industry that don't have any great love for the machine, but who understand business, that are going to run successful businesses. There are people who are going to find out that the way they're running a business and the way they're approaching their business makes them less essential. And it's going to be tragic.
That was profound and a good message.
The only way you can change the future is to be the future. Otherwise, instead of being proactive, you're being reactive. And I don't know that anybody's ever achieved great success by being reactive.
Wow. Mitch Snyder, thanks for coming on again and just having coffee with me, man.
Carm, you are one of the few people in the industry that no matter what I'm doing, no matter where I am, no matter what shape I'm in, I'll show up. I promise you.
This was the broken arm episode. Let's remember that.
Sounds like a bad Western, doesn't it?
Mitch Snyder and Carm at the Broken Arm Corral. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, sir. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.